This is the BBC.
Hello, you've downloaded a podcast of BBC Radio 4's The Food Programme. Welcome to our world, from cooking to culture, politics to pleasure. We hope you enjoy it. Here on The Food Programme, for decades now, we've been digging for the stories behind the food we eat, ranging through politics, pleasure, pain, even sometimes poetry. Things are nearly always not what they first seem. Perhaps the most prosaic and down-to-earth manifestation of our relationship with food is the label. The words and pictures on a packet, box, wrapper, bag and bottle are meant to tell us what we need to know, but they also convey things a manufacturer wants to tell us, the sales pitch, a mix of a story that tells us a lot more than we imagine.
I mean, food labels are really, really political and reflect societal judgments and perceptions of risk and danger and what's good and what's important. I think labels are fascinating in that way.
Labels are, it turns out, a big story and also a battleground. From what has to go on them to what doesn't.
The labels may not tell you so, but there are a lot of additives and manipulations in an everyday bottle of wine.
Food labels politely waiting for our attention when we decide to glance at the back of a package. They seem so familiar, yet they are the end result of a long process, of battles fought and won. And one reason we're looking at them now is that we may be at a crossroads.
We've had decades of legislation being decided at EU level, and labelling requirements have always been an important part of that. So we're incredibly entwined with the EU. As we leave the EU, the whole of food policy and regulation is potentially open to review.
And so let's dive right in and look into the technicolour, well, sometimes, world of the label. Let's unpack some of the terms, some of the big debates, and make sense of some of the arguments around one particular word. I was mulling over this programme the other day, daydreaming about some X-ray specs that could instantly show the full story behind a label, behind the words and the rest. Nice fantasy. Though our smartphones might be able to do it soon, just point and click. But for the moment, all that's in the future and beyond our budget. But this is radio, and that has its own magic. How about a time machine?
We've just entered the time tunnel.
Back to that, I promise, shortly. First, let me introduce our guide on this journey.
Well, we have around us lots and lots of food and labels, packets.
Meet Vitti Allender, who teaches food law at Cardiff Metropolitan University.
The label must convey mandatory information. So there's a certain amount of information that must go on under European law. And those would be the things that you expect to see on the label. The name of the food, the ingredients list, the durability indication, best before or use by date, information about allergens, for example, and sometimes origin information as well. The legislation requires that the consumer is not misled.
And is that the overarching thing?
Yes.
The consumer must not be misled.
Must not be misled. It must offer a high level of consumer protection so that the consumer can identify the nature of the food. As well as the mandatory information, there's a certain amount of voluntary information that the manufacturers, of course, want to put on their labels. And that might be to do with health and nutrition claims. It might be to do with pictorial representations of the food. And it might be to do with the overall image of the product.
Sounds simple? Well, things were not always regulated. Today's labelling laws have been centuries in the making. Perhaps I'd better explain the time machine. Vitti and I are at the Museum of Brands, Packaging and Advertising. The museum in central London's Ludbrooke Grove is an astonishing collection of the artefacts of British popular culture over several hundred years.
And we're here in search of food packaging, food labelling.
As we head into the time tunnel, the dial is set to the early 19th century.
Printed material, the magazines and posters and timetables and pamphlets. And now we're walking through a bit which is childhood. Jigsaw puzzles and a rocking horse and cosmetics. Here, in the next big glass-fronted panel, is food.
The celebrated Evesham relish.
Cadbury's cocoa essence, registered, guaranteed to be genuine cocoa, absolutely pure.
We've got tins of peaches, bottles and jars with all sorts of labels on. Mason's OK pickle.
Look at that.
Butter colour, vegetable butter colour.
Tomlinson's Lincoln butter powder quickens the process of churning, produces firm golden butter, and it keeps the milk sweet. But from that label, we can't actually see what's inside that product.
Because that's pre-legal labelling, isn't it?
Labelling.
I mean, people could choose what to put on their labels.
They
desiccated
did.
Soup, Edwards, economical and nutritious.
Yeah. Very broadly, about 120 years ago, we started to see some controls over food, but those controls really related to protecting the guilds, protecting the producers of food. Consumer protection was incidental, but there were some regulations relating to the nature, the substance and the quality of food. It really wasn't until the latter part of the 20th century that we saw specific legislation relating to food labelling. Health biscuits.
Health in red.
Health in biscuits.
Red.
The industrialisation of Britain went hand in hand with the early industrialisation of food, and with that came adulteration that sickened and killed unknown numbers of working people. Lead and mercury in sweets, ground up bones in flour, strychnine in beer, alum in bread. The tricks were exposed by some great public health pioneers, and that resulted in the first legislation protecting us from food crooks. But onward on our time travels.
Rose's lime juice cordial. McVitie, brands that we're familiar with today.
I love the posters. I mean, the posters really are dramatic, aren't they? Look at that big one behind us. The Bovril with the
big bull.
Yes, Bovril puts beef into you.
And it says, powerful, invigorating. It's about 4 foot high. This would be illegal now, wouldn't it?
The best gift to a sick friend is Bovril. So quite a general health claim. And those general health claims can't be made unless a very specific health claim is made at the same time.
Sitting with Vitti and looking at straightforward ingredients lists on packets of herbal tea, sweets, snack bars, tinned meats and soups, there were two familiar terms that told me almost nothing. Flavourings and natural flavourings. What do they mean?
A flavouring is a product not intended to be consumed as such, but is added to a food to impart or modify the odour or the taste. A natural flavouring substance is something that's naturally present and identifiable in nature. And it's extracted by traditional food preparation processes, such as distillation, for example.
Well, in a world where everything, in theory, has to be labelled, it's a sort of strange field, isn't it?
Yes, and if we think about additives in foods, if you have something like colours or preservatives or emulsifiers, you have to have the name or E number for that ingredient or for that additive. But when it comes to flavourings, they're treated differently. We have a European register of flavourings. There's about 1,000 flavourings on there. And if you go on and look at that register, the information on there wouldn't really make much sense to the consumer because they're unfamiliar chemical terms. And in order to give the consumer the best information, generally the word flavourings is used and all of those flavourings have to be approved. Natural flavourings are a subset of the flavourings, along with things like flavour improvers or smoke flavourings or flavour precursors.
Clear? Possibly not. That word natural, it seems to me, might be where subjectivity starts to creep in amongst all this legislated and regulated objectivity. Well, guess what? Following that notion takes you down a Lewis Carrollish rabbit hole.
My name is Jessica Tai and I'm an investigations manager at the Advertising Standards Authority.
The ASA gets around 30,000 complaints every year.
Earlier this year, we received a complaint about an outdoor poster ad for Go Ahead Goodness Bars. And the poster ad contained the claim crammed with 100% natural ingredients. And in this case, we had a complaint from a member of the public who challenged whether the claim, the reference to 100% natural ingredients, was misleading because they were concerned that the product contained some ingredients which didn't meet that natural description, essentially. We decided that this was a case that we needed to look into on a formal basis.
Back to that case in a moment. But this isn't just a question for a lexicographer. Figuring out what the word natural means when used in advertising and branding and packaging is a serious task, and not just in the UK and EU.
I'm Alan Levinovitz. I'm an associate professor of religious studies at James Madison University in Harrisonburg, Virginia.
Alan is actually writing a book on the subject, The Meaning of the Word Natural.
The United States Food and Drug Administration has actually also been trying to figure out what natural means. They've been doing it for decades. And recently, they kicked that question out to the public and asked people what they thought natural meant.
And why have they done this?
Well, the FDA needs to be able to regulate food, and they need to make sure that people aren't advertising food falsely. And right now, people pay more for food that is labeled natural. It's actually even more influential on people's purchasing decisions than the word organic. And so the FDA needs to have some set of criteria for deciding whether food labeled natural is advertising honestly or advertising falsely. I happen to like salty snacks. So these snacks here are called Chompers with a Z, and there's a picture of a shark on the package, which is strange because sharks don't eat these. These are crunchy seaweed chips. There's this shark licking his lips looking at these seaweed chips, and it says naturally delicious. The company that makes them, by the way, is Nature Snacks. There's absolutely nothing natural about them at all. Of course, there's no such thing as a seaweed chip, the glutinous rice flour, the rice bran oil, the tapioca starch. And yet, clearly, the people that made this package know that they have to call them naturally delicious in order to get people to purchase them. So if nothing else, the idea that natural is good has enormous power over consumers.
I suppose it's the use of the shark there that is particularly colorful.
he seems very high, smiling and licking his lips with a tongue. I'm not even sure sharks have tongues, but there you have it.
And Alan has been poring over the public responses to the FDA's inquiry.
Well, I read through thousands of these comments, and people were all over the map. You know, some people said everything is natural. You know, everything's made from stardust, so it doesn't matter whether it's plastic or a plant. And other people would say things like, we should only eat what God put on this earth. That's what's natural. And anything other than that, in the state that God made it, shouldn't be labeled natural. I came to the word natural in this project as an extreme skeptic. I was in the camp of people who think that everything is natural and the term is just meaningless and used to advertise things. But I've actually come to change my mind in many ways. Natural does have a meaning. It's just that it's difficult to define. Words like freedom and art are also difficult to define, but that doesn't mean that we should throw out the idea of freedom or throw out the idea of art. Instead, we need to think hard about how we can define those terms and the difficulties that are inherent in them.
And there's nothing new here. As Alan told me, Aristotle wrote about natural in terms of food, as did the learned ones in ancient China.
There is a term, ziran, which is usually translated as natural, which actually means self-so, things that are so of themselves. You also find them talking about how things that are so of themselves, things that are natural, are superior to things that are unnatural.
And so wrestling with this question as it applies to a biscuit bar advert, the UK Advertising Standards Authority issued a ruling focusing on chemically extracted, refined and deodorized sunflower oil, and the use of potassium carbonate solution to produce low-fat cocoa powder.
In this case, there were two ingredients in the product that had had chemical processing before they were added to the product. Ultimately, the complaint against the ad was upheld in this case, and that's because we considered consumers will understand natural to mean completely natural, and that will involve very minimal processing of any ingredients. You know, you don't see that claim on every single product out there, and this advertiser obviously felt that making the claim would entice consumers to buy their product over other products. So our job is just to look at what consumers will take from the claim in this case, and we think you actually can draw a line somewhere.
There's no way that these debates are going to be settled because, you know, what looks traditional to a modern person would look like the very apex of technological development when that thing was first introduced. So 100 years from now, you're going to have artisanal Chompers seaweed snacks that are made with sunflower oil or whatever it is that they're made with. And people say, oh, that's so wonderful. It's so natural and traditional. And there'll be some new thing that you ingest via helmet or something. And people will argue that that's untraditional, right? So it's there's moving goalposts here if you're defining natural according to what's traditional. There are certain kinds of food processing techniques, you know, the use of lye, for example, to transform grains in the ancient world was something that was an enormous breakthrough 6,000 years ago. But I don't think most people would believe that lye was used to transform the grains in their natural food. So that may be something that comes as a surprise. It's also the case that many of the techniques used to process so-called natural foods are actually the result of technological innovations by companies that are trying to avoid using unnatural ingredients and so need to come up with new emulsification techniques that don't require those ingredients in the first place.
Alan Levinowitz. The makers of Goodness Bars disagreed with the ASA but accepted their ruling, and they've withdrawn their natural advertising. This is all the ASA can influence. The bars are still on sale, flagging their naturalness. But the company tells us the packaging will no longer be selling itself as 100% natural by the end of the year. Just one example of a tension between consumer expectations and perceptions and the realities of food production.
I think manufacturers are working towards clean labelling, whereby a consumer can look at a label and think, yes, I understand those ingredients that are in there. I think where it falls down is that the consumer really has no idea about food manufacturing practices and how complex they are. And when they see something that looks like a relatively simple product, there's a lot of technological stages to go through in order to ensure that product is of quality and is safe to eat. So, for example, something a consumer would buy that's labelled as a pure fruit juice has many stages, very, very complex, in order to ensure that that product is consistent every time, that when you pick it off the supermarket shelf, it's always the same. Because, of course, oranges or apples or grapefruits, they change. They change in nature, and the product has to be consistent at the end. So it might mean adding more or less pulp to the product, more or less pith. The orange flavour from the skin of the product. It's all from the orange, but it's very technological in terms of making that juice consistently. And the consumer wants to be sure that when they go to the supermarket and pick that product off the shelf, it's the same every time. It's what they expect.
We're in the 1910s now. Look, Camp Coffee.
Van Houten's pure soluble cocoa, guaranteed to contain pure soluble cocoa of the finest quality and full weight.
It's like all the packaging, all the labelling is about reassurance. This is going to make your life better. Chelsea toffee for every man. Toffee for men.
And fitness can best be assured by drinking Ovaltine. It builds up brain.
Oh, yes, look at that.
Weetabix, more than a breakfast food. 24 ways to serve, ready to eat, ideal for every meal. Ideal for every meal will certainly go against nutrition guidelines.
Oh, Vimto.
Oh, Vimto. God, I love Vimto.
Vimto fruit tonic, the drink of health.
I probably thought that was true when I was six.
Probably.
Yeah.
Schweppes lemon squash. Cane sugar and other fine ingredients. So we're not seeing many ingredients lists on a lot of these products, but that's only a partial one. It's not really telling you what's in the product. Peak Freen's Twiglets.
Oh, no.
Twiglets.
The Epicure's savoury appetizer. That would still be all right, wouldn't it?
The way things are represented on a packet are big daily issues in the food business and amongst those who fight for food safety and our right to know what we're eating and drinking. One of the biggest and most contentious of those issues in modern times has just burst into life again in the United States. Dan Charles covers food and farming for NPR, National Public Radio, based in Washington, D.C.
Well, there's kind of a fundamental question. You know, if you make a rule about what goes on a label on food, you're sort of making a judgment about what is important for the consumer to know.
The first genetically modified GMO crops, soybeans and corn, were planted in farmers' fields in the mid to late 90s. They came on the market to much public opposition. In Europe, it was fairly easily agreed that any foods containing GMOs had to be labelled. In the US, it was different. The various arms of government rejected any labelling.
This is actually really interesting. A whole group of companies got together and said, we are going to come up with our own labelling scheme. I got some tortilla chips. And there's this lovely little label on the package. It says, non-GMO project verified. It's got a little butterfly. It's really a marketing thing to tell consumers who care that you can avoid GMO ingredients by buying food with that label on it. But it has all kinds of issues associated with it. You know, a lot of people say the label's actually confusing because people will put that label on food that there is no possibility anyway of having genetically modified ingredients in that food. There's even been non-GMO labels put on water. And it's become kind of this label that is supposed to tell the consumer, oh, this is maybe better for you, even when there's probably no evidence that it is actually better for you. And it's become actually kind of a competitor for organic food, which is also non-GMO. But it's a lot more expensive to grow organic food than it is to grow food that's just non-GMO.
Recently, though, with some states trialing their own labeling, the U.S. government has decided that a federal solution is better. So it seems there will be mandatory GMO labeling sometime soon. And the U.S. Department of Agriculture is floating proposals on what the labels will look like. In the meantime, some food manufacturers are doing it themselves.
So I went to the store last night, and I saw some soup cans that had the label produced with genetic engineering. Here I have another package. I've got a bag of Goldfish, Pepperidge Farm Goldfish baked snack crackers. And here on the label, it says right underneath the sort of the panel that has nutrition information, it says partially produced with genetic engineering. It's not legally mandated that they put that on the package, but increasingly food manufacturers are doing that. And the funny thing is, no one seems to be reacting. People don't seem to be avoiding these packages because of those words on the bag.
But when the USDA proposed labels start appearing, that might be rather different, might it? I mean, you've seen some of these new labels.
Well, the labels that the USDA proposed were almost comical in the image that they projected. You know, whoever was coming up with this at the U.S. Department of Agriculture clearly wanted to make a GMO label that made GMOs look as friendly as possible. You know, one of the proposals was kind of like in the shape of a sun with a little smiley face inside. And it said, you know, produced using bioengineering. They've avoided that acronym, GMO, because I guess they figure it's got like a bad image. There is clearly a difference of opinion in the food industry as to the probable effect of any kind of GMO label. There are certainly people in the industry who think that those labels will sort of scare people off and that it's going to sort of push food companies in the direction of just getting rid of all GMO ingredients in the food. But then there are others, you know, like the company that's putting out these Goldfish that seem to think that nobody's going to notice, basically. They'll put those words on the package and life will go on as before. I mean, food labels are really, really political and reflect societal judgments and perceptions of risk and danger and what's good and what's important. I think labels are fascinating in that way. And the GMO labeling fight was just like one facet of this bigger question.
Dan Charles, the label battles continue, but we have more time travel to do, and we've reached the Second World War.
During the war, the government made an order to take control of the food supply because what little food there was had to be of good quality.
A little note on the back of a food box. It says, waste paper is a vital war raw material. Do not burn this packet. Save it for your local salvage collector.
The labels on these products are looking much simpler than in previous times because those controls are on the paper supply.
Paper and ink, yeah.
This is a pack of beef suet. It has directions on it, but those directions have been stamped over. It says cancelled. This is a wartime emergency pack. So no frivolity using it as you did pre-war.
But this is the period when the labelling legislation came in, isn't
started
it?
To come in, yes.
You had to give the name and address of packer, name of food, minimum quantity of food in the pack, and the
and
ingredients.
The ingredients list.
Yeah. Now we've come into the 1950s.
We're seeing more foods that the housewife, as it would have been then, could prepare in the home. So we've got instant pudding, we've got some sponge mixture as well, and we've got convenience foods such as fish fingers.
Modern labels sum up a long food journey, but there's still a lot they don't tell us. Wine, cider, beer and spirit bottles reveal almost nothing. Doug Regg is founder of a wine company that specialises in what they call real wines. He's been in the business a long time and is well steeped in what doesn't have to appear on those lovely labels.
Take, for instance, a bottle of Sauvignon Blanc. Those familiar with the style will recognise descriptors such as gooseberry, grassiness, grapefruit and passion fruit. However, the presence and intensity of such flavours is more often than not achieved by the use of aromatic yeasts, which are introduced into the fermentation process. You can use these cultured yeasts to make pretty well any aroma or flavour that you want. It's done for commercial reasons to create perceived desirable outcomes, to create recognisable styles that consumers can relate to. The wine in the same bottle of Sauvignon may have been manipulated in a host of other different ways. Some will involve chemical and biological agents, often to manage the process of fermentation, others to affect the flavour and mouthfeel of the wine or to clean up the appearance. There's an approved list of between 50 to 100 chemical additions and probably an equal number of processes that make somewhat more than a mere fermented grape juice.
Then there's the imported apple juice concentrate in some real ciders, the colourings in some aperitifs. And what about the plastic used to heat seal most tea bags on sale right now in the UK? Nothing as yet about that has to be on the label. But then there's the perfectly legal, but potentially misleading. Recipe writers often tell you to use unwaxed lemons if you want to grate the zest into cakes and puddings. So for years I did, before I spotted some tiny print on the label saying, these lemons are treated with pyrimethinil and imazilil. Both are fungicides. This was news to me. Imazilil is listed as a likely human carcinogen by the World Health Organization. It turns out unwaxed has no legal definition. One major supermarket that we contacted told us, the allowed post-harvest treatments for our unwaxed lemons are 2,4-D, imazilil, prochloraz, propiconazole, pyrimethinil, thibendazole, and E202. Then, how about misleading with charm? Viti pulled out of her bag a pale pink packet of powdered pudding, decorated with a sweet sketch of a strawberry.
If the picture of the strawberry is given, and it says made with real fruit, then the flavour must wholly or mainly come from that product.
Strawberry powder, 2%.
The 2% strawberry powder, if it constitutes 51% of the flavouring in that product, that strawberry flavouring, it's permitted.
Now, there's something in labelling called the carryover principle. What does it mean?
The carryover principle affects the labelling, the ingredients labelling of products. And what it says is that if you have an additive in a final product, that additive is only there because it was one of the ingredients and it serves no technological function in the final product, then it doesn't need to be mentioned in the ingredients list of the final product unless it's an allergen. I've got some table salt here. The ingredients in this table salt are salt and an anti-caking agent, sodium hexacyanoferrate 2. That anti-caking agent is in that salt to stop it caking in its dry format. When this salt is put into another product, for example, a soup, the anti-caking agent has no technological function in that final product because it's not caking that dried salt together anymore. And so it doesn't need to be mentioned.
Even though you're eating it?
Even though you're eating it.
But let's head back to our time machine for one last go.
Now we're in the 1960s. there's a toy model of the Apollo space
launch. Here, Houston, how do you copy Houston?
Batmobile.
Oh, a talking Batmobile.
This is such a contrast, isn't it, to the Victorian and Edwardian stuff that we saw. I mean, there are some claims, but it's fading away.
Lucozade sparkling glucose drink replaces lost energy, and I'm sure a lot of us remember Lucozade being the drink that aids recovery when you were a child in that amber-coloured plastic wrapper. And then the company did a huge rebrand and it became a sports drink. Through the 80s, lots of snack foods, packets of Monster Munch, Ringos. We're seeing some pre-prepared meals, some ready meals, specifically for weight control. Claims on their low in fat, high in fibre and starch, controlled sodium.
So here we are, 1990s, with gingerbread dinosaurs and Ed the Duck milkshake and Anchor half fat. You start seeing this emphasis on low fat.
And suddenly we're seeing a new word on some of the ready meals. They're saying microwavable.
Vitti and I emerge from the time tunnel into the present day. What might 2020's food labelling look like from a future time tunnel? Sue Davis works on food policy for consumer rights organisation Which.
We know from the research that certainly people have high confidence at the moment, and that confidence is very fragile. We saw with the horse meat scare what can happen if we get this wrong or if people start to suspect that labels are misleading.
What are the biggest risks, would you say?
As we leave the EU, the whole of food policy and regulation is potentially open to review. We want to make sure that we maintain the really important protections that we've fought for over many years and the general framework that we've got that works well for consumers. There are some areas where it needs to be strengthened, but what we absolutely have to ensure is that we don't drop standards, that we don't trade away some of the really important food standards as we start to negotiate trade deals with other countries and make sure that consumer interests are the priority.
Chris Elliott is Professor of Food Safety at Queen's University Belfast and the man who wrote an unflinching report on our horse meat scandal.
Our labelling legislation is very much thought of one of the most complex areas that has been legislated over the years, and still many people complain there's either too little or too much regulations around labelling. In terms of the enforcement, I think right across the whole regulatory environment in food, those people who do that job for us right across the UK, the services have been cut right to the bone. And would I say there's the same amount of inspection and scrutiny going on now as there was 10 years ago? I think that's very, very unlikely.
But without the backup of enforcement, what's the real value of a label?
There is much less enforcement happening now than was the past. Those people who look after this for us, I mean, the services are just no longer there. I mean, they're stretched and trying to do as good a job in protecting UK consumers to make sure that the food they eat is safe and is authentic. But such a challenge in these very difficult times.
An uncomfortable reality. Back to the couch, and Vitti has been down the sweets aisle.
So, the new Smarties have... opening the bag. Okay. New Smarties have big claim on the box, ingredient from nature's colourful palette. Seaweed, hibiscus, black carrot, safflower, radish and lemon.
Part of the determination for choosing certain ingredients will be that they look good on the label.
I mean, if you were a parent and your child wanted sweets, this would be very appealing. Ingredients from nature's colourful palette. Here we are, we're surrounded by all these packets. Let's have a jelly baby. Okay, would you want one?
Thank you.
Marvellous. Thanks for listening. If you want to hear more food programmes, then there's a treasure trove of them going back to 2007 on the BBC Radio 4 food programme website.
This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Evan Davis, and I'm here to briefly tell you about my new podcast, Sweet Reason. These are polarised times, debates on social media are pretty shouty sometimes and can pull to the extremes. So in 6 programmes, we're trying a bit of an experiment. We'll be trying to have reasonable discussions on the most emotive of issues. Topics like patriarchy, or whether people are too ready to take offence these days, identity politics, that kind of thing. I'll be with guests in the studio and out and about as well. And my mission is to foster agreement, or at least to better understand disagreement. So do subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.